Hi, and welcome to Measure to Metric, a podcast about engineering monuments, the people who built them, and the people who use them. My name, as always, is Vivian Yu.
And my name is John Julius.
I'm a civil engineer.
I'm married to a civil engineer.
And every episode, we're going to pick one engineering monument. Maybe it's ancient, or maybe it's brand new, from somewhere in the world.
In this case, we're going to tell you where it is. We're going to tell you kind of when it was built, but not really. We are going to tell you how big it is.
That's right.
We're going to spend a little bit less time on the impressive engineering aspects of it, because you're gonna find this out. You're going to get it. But we are going to talk about the scale and importance.
That's right. So today we're talking about the Great Wall of China, and we're going to take today's episode a little bit differently. It's been a real crazy week at work. So John has been picking up a lot of the research for this episode instead of me.
Yeah, I'm really thrilled about this particular episode. Like, for all of the weeks for me to have to take a little bit more of a lead on the research, this is like, I now get to explain Chinese history to Vivian. So, I mean, let's just take a second to appreciate the position that, you know, puts me in.
Right. So, you know, if there are inconsistencies, or maybe this episode feels a little bit different, now you know why.
Yes. And also, if you like it, let us know.
It's true. A lot of feedback that I've gotten so far has been that, oh, your husband is so funny and so good on the podcast, which is, you know, yes, I know he's great, but, you know, hurt feelings, guys, hurt feelings.
Yes. Also, just before we get started, right now, there is a lot of, I think, very justified outrage, and just, I don't think that we can release anything publicly without acknowledging that, you know, we fully back Black Lives Matter. We offer our full support to the ending of police brutality. This is something that we've been dealing with, I mean, a little bit more privately outside of the podcast, but I don't want to put anything out into the world right now without expressing that support and urging you to please, please do what you can to, you know, help support the cause of anti-police brutality. That is not a controversial stance to take.
Yeah, I think in the past, we've definitely touched on a lot of the monuments that have been built with the lives, really, of Black people, and a lot of monuments that were built by either slaves or really close, you know, direct descendants of slaves. Thinking about the Panama Canal episode, knowing that a lot of workers were from the Caribbean and they were paid, you know, substantially less than white workers, and they were treated unfairly. And I know we glossed over them, and I apologize if we haven't been able to really do them justice and focus on the fact that a lot of these monuments have been built by Black people and by the Black community. And there's been a lot of sacrifices that have been made because of just colonialism and the systemic racism that have happened in the past and still occurs today. So, yeah, just wanted to take a minute to recognize that. And I've been putting a lot of thought, even before the recent developments, about the monuments that Black communities have put their stamps on. So, you know, we don't want to jump on the bandwagon and kind of publish something that's not polished and not well thought through. So that will be coming, and that is on the list. We just want to make sure we do it well.
So, shall we begin?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, so we are talking about the Great Wall of China, which is, so I can't remember, where is it again? It's in northern China. When you're growing up in school, you know, you learn that the Great Wall of China was built to protect the northern border of China against Mongol invaders.
That's right.
Well, it goes back, you know, considerably farther than that. So the Great Wall of China, how big is it?
It's over 20,000 kilometers long. It varies in width and height, but on average, it's about 8 meters high.
Yeah. So.
And it's built on the ridges of the landscape. So, you know, the landscape is quite varied. It's got rolling hills and mountains. And so they've built the wall kind of on the highest points to make sure that it's, you know, a good barrier and it takes advantage of the local landscapes.
Yeah. So again, like we're talking about, the height is an 8 meter tall wall, mm-hmm. is nothing to write home about. A 21,000 kilometer long wall built over very difficult terrain is amazing. But it didn't come together overnight. Some of the sources that I've read, you know, kind of credit the wall going back as far as the 7th century BC. So way back. And this was not a concentrated effort to build a great wall. This was just various civilizations living in modern day China that were building walls to protect themselves largely from each other.
That's right. You know, I think if you grew up in China, certainly my mom has a very good handle on the history of the dynasties that have governed and lived in China. To me, they all blur, right? Like, it's the same as how, you know, probably most European can name, like, it's the Victorian era and then the Georgian and then the Elizabethan was before that. Anyway, you know what I mean? Like, they know their progression of history and the main, you know, empires and dynasties. To me, the Ming dynasty, the Qing dynasty, like all of those, they just blur together because I didn't do my education in Asia.
Right.
But definitely the Great Wall was built even from before the first emperor, the official emperor of China in the Qing dynasty. It was, parts of it was already built and kind of in place before that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so then this, it's Qing?
I think so. That's how I would say it.
I'm just going to say, okay, Qing Shi Huang. So the first emperor of China was, you know, he
Aw.
No, that was a joke. So he kind of looked and he said, oh, well, we have all of these walls, all of these small walls, right? But I want to be the emperor of China. So we got to take these walls, we have to join them together, we have to get rid of all of the walls that, you know, separate segments of my domain,
mm-hmm.
right? And so that was 3rd century BC is largely credited as to when what we regard as the Great Wall of China today was formed.
Yeah, so that's a really good point to actually focus on because the first emperor, I don't know how to say it in Mandarin, I'm seeing it, but in Cantonese, the way I know it is Chen Ti Wang.
Okay.
So that's how I would call him in Cantonese. Yeah. As the first emperor of China, he was the first one to unite all the different tribes of China. So before there were just a lot of various tribal settlements, and he was the first one to unite them as one joint empire. He is also the one who built the terracotta army.
Oh, okay.
Right. So all the kind of big early Chinese monuments that you could think of, that's him.
Yeah.
And we should also note that back then, the capital of China was not Beijing.
Right.
The Qing dynasty was centered around kind of the edge of where the Silk Road meets China. So that's at Xi'an.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of further inland in China. And so that's where the capital was. That's what he was trying to protect, both the capital and the Silk Road kind of trade route.
Right.
Right. So just wanted to add a little color around this dude.
Yeah. You know, sounds like a very important figure.
Yes.
In Chinese history. You know, we're going back to like 200 BC. And this was at a time when I think a lot of when the concept of centralized rule was becoming more, you know, a more modern version, closer to how we understand it today. Because when you look at the map, like when we talk about ancient China or ancient, basically any ancient country, right? Like the civilizations have grown and evolved very differently. But this, we have like a centralized border, blah, blah, blah. Anyhow.
Right. It's turning into a real empire, right? Like you think of how Romans before they were an empire were probably the same, like mm-hmm. tribal units and then.
Yeah. Yeah. Germanic tribes. And
exactly. This was when China became an empire.
Another concept that I found very interesting when they first started like kind of building this wall, tearing down the sections that separated the empire and fortifying sections that defined the edges of the empire, the term that they kind of used when building it was like build and move on.
Mm.
So this wall was not at this time was not exactly this like, you know, we need a strong fortification kind of a thing. It was like almost symbolic.
Yeah, like a land border.
Yeah. It would have certainly made defense and all that a little bit easier, but, right, you're not building like a perfect great wall.
Yeah, it's almost like planting a flag and being like, this is mine now.
Yeah.
Was essentially what he was doing. And so at this time, you can imagine the wall wasn't what you're imagining it looking like now, mm-hmm. right? At that time, it wasn't brick and mortar. It was rammed earth, which I'll go more into. It was, yeah, a bit more makeshift.
Yeah. Also, very, very little of that wall actually still exists today.
Yes, because, that's true.
Yeah, because it was like 1,000 and some years later was when the Ming Dynasty took over.
That's right.
And the Ming Dynasty had a need for a far more robust wall.
Yes. Right. I think at that point, it was less about keeping out Mongol tribes. You know, they would be raiding villages on the border and doing little battles, right? With the Ming Dynasty, we're talking about actual warfare. We're talking about two civilizations now engaged in major battles and not in little tribal raids and disputes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, this was like, we're now getting into...
Like, you know, the Mulan
yeah.
part of our history. I there, hope that's a go. Good context for the Western folks.
Yeah, yeah. So also, I think that it's interesting. We call it the Great Wall of China, and that's basically, as a Westerner,
mm-hmm.
that's what I think to call it. But if you go to China,
we call it the Long Wall.
The Long Wall.
Literally the Long Wall.
Yeah.
Cheng Sing, which is also Cantonese again.
You don't have to apologize for speaking Cantonese.
I know, I
maybe,
know.
I don't know. I'm not going to tell you how to live. So I find this part interesting because we always like to talk about the budget.
Mm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
how much did this thing cost? Well, who knows, right? Like, money was way different back then. When you're talking about something that was built over literally thousands of years, right?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Per usual, they got it for cheap. They built it as cheaply as they possibly could. So basically, they had the soldiers, convicts, they had, you know, commoners. Like, everybody was just put to work building this wall. And... you know, again, there's not a lot of firm detail about, you know, working conditions or what sort of thing. I'm sure that across such a great length.
Yeah, I mean, there's no written record of how they treated the people, but there are actually quite a bit of poetry and songs. So, you know, ancient China and Chinese history, a lot of it is passed down in poetry. And it's written, right? A mm-hmm. lot of our history is written. We're just a very literary people before the Cultural Revolution. So, yeah, there are songs about, you know, the sacrifices of a family to send someone to go build the wall, or, you know, widows crying over their husbands dying on the wall.
Yeah.
And not because of fights, right? We're not talking about, this is a military installation. We're not talking about them dying on battle. We're talking about them dying building the wall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, as with, you know, many of the monuments that we cover, this wall was built largely in human blood.
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot of probably well-founded legends that there are bodies buried in the wall. And there's a lot of blood, sweat, and tears that went into the wall. And that's built into a lot of the songs about the wall. So we don't know the actual cost or the budget of building the wall, but I read somewhere that a few engineers, you know, thought themselves pretty clever and went out to the wall and tried to budget out like how many man hours it would take.
Okay.
Right? Because that's how you kind of budget something of this scale and history. They estimated like roughly 90,000 man hours.
Okay.
To build the wall. And obviously that can't even be realistic, because what we'll talk about probably in more of the history is that the wall was successively repaired. Always. There was always a maintenance budget for the wall, right? Every single emperor that came after Chen Si Wang understood the importance of the wall, and they would fortify it, they would build up parts of it, they would always maintain it after a raid or after an invasion.
Mm-hmm.
It was constantly being worked on.
Yeah. So they're saying 90,000, whatever, but it's just like, add to that just right. every minute of every day, some part of that wall was, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We should also say that the wall is not just a wall, right? There are a lot of things that are associated and make up the Great Wall of China, including the watchtowers,
right?
The fortresses, there are passes, so kind of like a mountain, there are points where you can pass through the wall, and those areas are fortified so that you can gather your soldiers there, all the horses there. It's big military installation. I feel like a lot of people have seen pictures of the Great Wall of China, so you probably already know this, but it is not literally like one vertical face wall.
Yeah, it kind of curves and it has turrets and it has all sorts of...
Yes.
Yeah.
And it actually served as a road as well, because it's basically two walls with a built-up kind of roadway in between.
Right.
It's a fairly wide kind of section, and it allowed the Chinese military to use it as a road to kind of patrol the border or move troops quickly in between.
Right.
We can also talk about the use of the different watchtowers. So obviously this was a point that would be heavily guarded.
Right.
So there'd be a lot of military troops and guards. They would watch out for any invasions. If something happened, the watchtowers were built on specific high points so that they could send each other smoke signals and be able to warn.
Oh, clever.
Neighboring villages and such that, you know, they should take guard and be careful, because there might be an invasion coming.
Right.
Talking about kind of how they built it, the Great Wall of China stretches over quite a distance, right? So it goes from kind of where North Korea touches China and wraps around Beijing, and then it goes further inland, kind of wrapping around close to the border of Mongolia, and then stops past Xi'an, the ancient capital.
Right.
If you can imagine, I always think of like the shape of China like Mickey Mouse. You know what I mean? Because it kind of looks like a Mickey Mouse with two ears, right?
Yeah.
So it's like it wraps around kind of like on the bottom of the right ear. Goes around the head. And then it doesn't quite touch all the way to the other side of China. It kind of ends before it like touches the other ear.
Right.
Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah.
That's how I picture it.
I can see it. I can see it.
Right. So like I said before, it protects the capitals. It protects the neighboring villages. It protects the trade route. And because it stretches over such a vast distance, you have to remember that China has a lot of diverse landscapes. So that wall actually goes through mountains, hillsides. It goes through deserts.
Mm-hmm.
And so rather than like in Stonehenge, if you remember that episode, where they brought in specific rocks, like we wanted those rocks from Wales or whatever, and we're going to ship them in. We want specifically these guys here. The Great Wall was not like that. It was very much, what do we have right here?
Yeah.
So that we could build this as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
So the first beginnings of the wall was built with rammed earth. And what this is essentially using earth kind of like you would concrete. So you would build up like a mold. And so a mold of a wall. And then you would stuff earth into it, compact it, and then break down the molds.
Right.
Right. So it was very much just an earth embankment.
Okay. Kind of almost like a reverse ditch.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's what this wall originally would have looked like. Now, they also did this with some of the areas where they didn't have earth. So where they were going through deserts, they didn't have earth. Right. And so they actually, there are parts of the wall that are built with, I call them sandcastles, but they were essentially sandcastles.
Nice.
And they're not just sand, right? There's reeds and other materials that have been kind of mushed up into it to give it a bit more integrity and hold it together.
Right.
But you can look up pictures, or we'll post pictures of sections of the wall that do look like sand dunes and sandcastles. Hmm. And that's what they used, like, locally to build that. By the time we were kind of into the Ming Dynasty and they were getting more sophisticated, we're definitely getting into the material that you would think of now, where we built bricks and brought in some rocks. And they were very careful not to bring in, like, giant rocks from somewhere else. It was very much a, okay, we kind of got rocks around here. We'll just shape it and we'll mortar it and, you know, add bricks to it to kind of make it work.
Yeah.
And then backfill it with dirt. So remember how I said the wall basically has two faces, right? It has two brick and rock faces, and in between is filled in to make this kind of road. So the filled in part is going to be earth again.
Right.
And they set up quite an operation of kilns and, you know, things to build bricks with locally.
Okay.
And they also had mortar, which is kind of like cement of the time, to cement all the bricks together.
Right.
And I mean, this is kind of a myth, but I think they actually confirmed this with some testing. But they found that the mortar was reinforced and strengthened with sticky rice.
That's adorable.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
This is just like, I know. Okay. We're Chinese. We will make anything out of rice. Anything.
Yeah. Anything you want, just go.
We can make it with rice.
Yeah. Oh, man. That's adorable. I like it.
You know, our biggest iconic monument has rice in it. That's just, of course. That's like, if the Americans were to make their wall with Mexico out of French fries, like, that would be great.
Yeah. There you go. Real Idaho potatoes.
Right. So the wall was also, like I said, takes advantage of the natural curvature in the landscapes and the topography. They were very much about finding kind of the highest point. You know, this was a military defensive position like you would anywhere else. You find the highest point and you defend it from there, right? So they would get to the ridges. They would level it off a bit, put down a bit of a foundation using heavy stone slabs.
Okay.
And then build up from there.
Yeah.
You didn't haul a lot of material from afar, but you definitely had to carry it up the mountain for the most part.
Yeah.
There were some beasts of burden. So we're talking about like oxen and donkeys and whatnot. But usually those were too precious and used for farming than they were used for construction. And what is less precious than oxen and mule are people.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's the world, isn't it? I mean, before I was a little bit dismissive. I was like, oh, the wall is only 8 meters tall, right? But think about that for a minute. 8 meters at the top of a hill.
You're not jumping over that.
Yeah, no, exactly. It's like I'm basically 2 meters tall. Right. And it's like, that's four. I'd have to climb.
Yeah.
It's
like that 8 meters. That is how I measure most heights, or like small distances, actually, is how many jaunts does it Like, John's 2 meters. Well, it's 8 meters. It's 4 Johns high.
So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I just think last time we were talking about the CN Tower, right?
That's a lot of Johns.
That's a lot. And that doesn't even impress me. So, you know, think about...
Right, think about over 20,000 kilometers.
Exactly.
It's quite significant. And the thing is, you know, let's not talk about, like, Genghis Khan's whole campaign, right? We're not talking about that. We're talking about the daily tribal interactions with the Mongol before they were the empire.
Yeah.
It was very rare for them to go very far for raids, right? They were not keen on having to take their horses at great distances just to invade a village. They were more likely to just pick on easier prey, basically.
Yeah.
So a little bit of a wall, it really did help to prevent most of the small invasions and, you know, make sure that they weren't using the villages like a supermarket, you know?
Yeah, exactly. It was a lot more about discouragement than actual in the early days.
Yeah. And by the time you get to the battle, it was also a line of gathering, right? Like, this is where you station your troops. This is the border. This is where, you know, you would gather and forge your defense. And it's fairly significant. It's also a fairly, I'm not going to say desolate, but like, it's a tough area, right? If you can think of Mongolia being quite remote and quite a hostile environment, like, this is just south of that.
Yeah.
It's quite a bit north of the equator, right?
Yep.
It's fairly north. So you would think it would be cold or at least temperate. It's not. Like, it's a harsh landscape. There are areas where it is desert. And I remember visiting when I was really quite young. I think I was 6 at the time. And we visited in the summer. And my dad is a very outdoorsy kind of guy. And he just wanted to, like, he was racing like teenagers on the wall, right? Of course, like, you know, my father, he would do that. He would just be like, let's race 2 kilometers and then come back. And I didn't try to keep up, but like, he definitely tried to make me hike it on a hot summer day when I was 5. And I fainted and he had to carry me back.
Oh, geez.
So like, it's a very tough area. It's a tough terrain for a 5-year-old and for most people. So if you do visit, there's a lot of warnings about, you know, make sure that you have enough water, make sure that you have enough sustenance, and make sure you take breaks, because there's also no shade, right? There's no big trees up there. It is wide open.
Yeah, it's like, even in the lusher areas, this wall was specifically designed to be the tallest thing around.
That's right.
You can't have a tree that's taller than your wall, because people are going to climb the tree instead of climbing the wall. Totally undermined the whole purpose. So bring a hat. If you go to visit the Great Wall of China, bring a hat, bring some water, because this was designed to be a tough thing to deal with. Also, all of the images of, you know, ancient Chinese soldiers wearing hats.
Helmets, John.
Helmets.
Helmets.
I know, but hats. I mean, a helmet is a hat.
All right. Helmet is a hat. That's going to be the title of our episode.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Look, yeah. All helmets are hats. Not all hats are helmets. Now that we've got that out of the way.
I hope you learned something today.
Yeah. That's my contribution. A true contribution.
Right. Obviously, you can still visit it today, and there's a lot of reparation works that have gone to making sure that it's still somewhere that you can visit and really spend time with. There are sections, obviously, that are no longer there. So after Mongolia was no longer a military threat to China, and the wall kind of lost its purpose, some of the sections of the wall were taken down because it was just good building material.
Right.
And so a lot of the original bricks and stones are probably not there anymore. They were taken down to build villages, cities, towns, all of that. A lot of it was also eroded. So if you think of some of the desert areas, those sections, it was built with sand and reed, but it was built with sand.
Yeah. And then you're going to have the wind blowing sand at your sand, and it's all just, it's not going to last.
Yeah. A large section has been eroded away. And, you know, we do have very violent rivers that cut through China with very kind of turbulent and unexpected sudden rise in water levels. So those have eroded some parts away as well. The part where it actually comes to the sea, right, where it reaches the coast of China, I've seen pictures of that. And that's actually quite impressive, because if you think of this wall, like stretching all this way across the land and then suddenly coming to stop at the ocean, like it's mm-hmm. quite a dramatic place. But yeah, there are kind of crumblings and piles of rocks there. It's not really a wall per se, but you can see the footprints of it.
Nice.
So there are obviously specific sites that are nice to visit if you want to get the full experience, if you want to see the whole thing in not its entirety, but kind of get a grasp of the different parts of it. The parts right above Beijing is obviously going to be the most popular. That's mm-hmm. going to be the most visited. It's the most restored. It's not historically accurate or really like real anymore. But that is going to be that picturesque, like what you imagine the Great Wall in all the pictures. That's where you're going to see it.
Yeah.
And for a while, the Chinese government was really hesitant to actually limit the amount of people visiting because they were afraid of its impact to tourism.
Yeah. Yeah. They're worried about impacting like the revenue coming in. They wanted as many people going to that wall as possible, which... anytime that you get, you know, a large group of people together,
it's going to deteriorate.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
People like carving their initials and all of that sort of thing. Up until fairly recently, so what are we looking at? I think 2003 was when they regulated the Beijing portion of the wall. So 2003, I mean, we were in grade 10.
Yeah, grade 9 or 10.
Yeah,
yeah, it's fairly recent.
That's very recent. Like, I don't know how close you could get. Well, maybe you could still go. It doesn't matter.
Oh, yeah, you could definitely still go on it. You could still walk on it.
Yeah, sorry. But I just think of, like, the general clampdown on, like, tourists getting too close to the edge and all of that as something that largely started kind of in the 70s when international travel became, right? So yeah, it was quite late where they actually started like taking it seriously to prevent people damaging the wall.
Yes. And also, of course, putting in more funding to restore the wall. It is one of the world's 100 most endangered sites, according to the World Monuments Fund. It is also one of the 7 wonders of the world, the modern 7 wonders of the world.
We'll cover the criterion of how they decided that. Right? Because it's not like they just say, oh, this is a good looking wall. You know, I consider this a wonder. The Great Wall had to pass a test to be named a wonder.
Do you want to talk about that now?
Yeah, sure.
So this is the UNESCO criteria for naming it a modern wonder.
Criterion 1. The Great Wall of the Ming is, not only because of the ambitious character of the undertaking, but also the perfection of its construction, an absolute masterpiece. We got some art critics on the UNESCO review committee. The only work built by human hands on this planet that can be seen from the moon. Think about that for a second.
I feel like we need to fact check that. I've seen so many things. You can see it from space. You can't see it from space. You can't see it from space. You can't see it from space. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm
Does it
quoting...
depend on where the moon is? Because the moon moves, doesn't it? I'm sure there are places on the moon and at specific times you cannot see the wall.
But
and if... maybe the guy was just there at that time and was like, can't see the wall. Must not be true.
Yeah. No, here's the thing that messes me up about that. So the wall is 21,000 kilometers long.
Yeah.
You can definitely see something that's 21,000 kilometers long from space.
But
But
it's only like 9 meters wide.
Right? So that's like you have the world's longest hair. Yeah. And you lay that out on the ground and then you get up on a ladder.
Can you see that?
Can you see that? I don't know. So anyways, we came into this episode a little bit half-cocked on this argument because neither of us actually did the research. We thought of like all the reasons why we think, oh, that seems unlikely, but I didn't actually Google to see if there's a photo of the Great Wall taken from the space station or anything like that. So we're going to do that. We're going to post the photo if one exists.
Yeah, well, yeah. We'll circle back.
So, however, one thing that is true, the Great Wall of China is generally the only human construction that is included on like the majority of maps.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it has been a part of the cartographic landscape of China for a very long time.
Huh, that's great.
Yep.
I like this part. So finishing off the first criteria, the wall constitutes, on a vast scale of a continent, a perfect example of architecture integrated into the landscape.
Yes.
And anyone who knows anything about architecture knows this is the highest praise that you can possibly have in architecture, right? The fact that we built seamlessly into the landscape is like the whole reason why Frank Lloyd Wright is a guy. Like, it's his whole raison d'etre, so.
Yeah. So, all right, criterion two. During the
I don't even know how to say that one, sorry. Okay.
During a specific period, the Chinese imposed their models of construction and organization of space in building the defense works along the northern frontier. The spread of Sinicism, S-I-N-I-C-I-S-M, not cynicism like you're an unlikable jerk, Sinicism. Spread of Sinicism was accentuated by the population transfers necessitated by the Great Wall.
What is Sinicism?
So a custom or trait peculiar to the Chinese.
Right, okay. Right? The spread of Sinicism. Oh, I love that I know a word for Chinesian now.
Yeah. So basically the wall was because of the way people moved to build the wall and to take advantage of the wall, it was a tremendous factor in the spread of like, you know, knowledge of Chinese culture,
right,
getting out into the world.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Very cool.
Yeah. Criterion three, that the Great Wall bear exceptional testimony to the civilizations of ancient China is illustrated as much by the rammed earth sections of fortifications dating from the Western Han that are conserved in the Gansu province as by the admirable and universally acclaimed masonry of the Ming period. So as you travel along this wall, you can see the different kind of the evolution of Chinese history and culture played out in the wall itself.
That's great. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah. I have a lot of trouble like reading this without smirking because I can just imagine the person who wrote these criteria, like talking about wine. There's a delicate floral bouquet. So anyhow.
Very intellectual, yeah.
I'm gonna read you the quote, but I'm gonna continue to like break it down into less obnoxious
English
language. Yeah. Criterion four. This complex and diachronic cultural property is an outstanding and unique example of a military architectural ensemble, which served a single strategic purpose for 2,000 years, but whose construction history illustrates successive advances in defense techniques and adaptation to changing political contexts. So, basically, the wall has always been built for the same purpose.
And yet it's
As the needs of that purpose have changed, as the technology available to, you know, fulfill that purpose has changed, the wall has evolved with it. So it is, again, we're just coming back to this is a representative.
Yeah. It's an ancient monument that really is also a living monument, isn't it?
Yep.
That's very cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, now I think that we're seeing in a lot of ways, we are seeing it sort of be like locked down, right?
Yeah.
Like this is what the wall is. We are going to preserve it as such, which largely started in 1950s, I believe. And then now in 2003, when it's like, this is a tourist thing. We want people, you know, 50 years from now to come and see the same thing. So it I mean, its purpose has changed, I think. And again, as international travel has become more things, you want to preserve these monuments rather than letting them evolve with your modern culture.
Well, yeah, I think given all the previous criteria talking about how it's so representative of Chinese history, right? That you can see the evolution of Chinese history in a construction monument. Like, how often do you get to say that about anything else?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that is something that you want to preserve and pass on and allow people to understand and witness.
Yeah, for sure. All right. And criterion 6, the Great Wall has an incomparable symbolic significance in the history of China. Its purpose was to protect China from outside aggression, but also to preserve its culture from the customs of foreign barbarians. Because its construction implied suffering, it is one of the essential references in Chinese literature, being found in works like The Soldier's Ballad of Qianling, circa 200 AD, or the poems of Tu Fu, from 712 to 770 AD, and the popular novels of the Ming period.
Yeah, it is very central to Chinese literature, for sure.
Yep. I mean, it's central to, you know, Chinese literature, to Chinese culture within China. And it's also such a powerful, you know, symbol of Chinese culture outside of China.
Yeah.
Right? Like when I was researching this, a lot of it just talks about how important the Great Wall is to the perception of China from outside China.
Absolutely.
It's a very cool, like, look into how, well, we've said it now, I think probably 6 times, but how Chinese culture has evolved and how it has innovated to meet current needs and all of this. Yeah.
So in my mind, like I said, my parents would have a much better understanding of like the various dynasties and evolution of Chinese history. But in my mind, there were kind of really like two real periods of Chinese history and civilization, right? You can think of Qin Ti Huang, that's our first emperor. And that was when the capital was near the Silk Route, right? That was that was one kind of major part of Chinese history. And then there's the Ming Dynasty and kind of the, I think, 14th century, 15th century, like that era. And that part of Chinese history, like I said, the Mulan and that part. And to me, there's that division, right? So you can see the first part through the terracotta armies. You can see the monuments there and how history, like how Chinese monuments look like then. If you go to the old city, the old capital, and it's beautiful there. The fortifications around the city are still there. You can walk all the way around the wall and the big fortress. It's still completely enclosed. It's a really beautiful place. And then you go to Beijing and you've got the Forbidden City, which is then, you're seeing the height of Chinese history, right? You're seeing the height of when the empire was at its power and, you know, the imperialism. But those are kind of very static monuments representing two points in history, whereas the Great Wall of Scenes really connects, like, is a tapestry of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's just very cool. I know this has not been super engineering, but this is a monument that is representing so much. I think we can all aspire to build something that would be so iconic.
Yeah.
And so enduring and be so capable at being so symbolic of so many things.
Yeah. You know, I feel like this episode was, I mean, pretty scattered, obviously, as a result of me. Look, I'm not an engineer, okay? I'm never going to be the guy who's like, well, I have 6 ideas and I need to put these 6 ideas into 6 boxes, right? So
maybe you enjoyed this bit better because it's more organic and more of a conversation. Yeah. I hope this was a good change. And if not, we won't do it again unless I get really busy again.
Yeah. Just let us know. Do you like hearing me ask questions and make jokes? Or do you like hearing me quote something that I read? And so also, I mean, you know, we sometimes joke about me being dumb. I'm not dumb.
John is not dumb.
I'm not dumb. I have some education. I don't think that education makes you smart or whatever, but like I did finish university. Like I can 5 years on a 4-year degree. That's not that bad. But my point is I can operate in an academic context. I generally choose not to, because I think that there's more important forms of intelligence than strict academic intelligence. But when I need to, I can operate. So anyhow, that's a bit about me.
John is very smart. He wants everyone to know this. And I agree, he is. I think, yeah, a big part of this podcast is to break down the intellectual barriers that sometimes academia and science can put up. And we just want to make it accessible for everyone.
Yeah.
To understand, you know, how we built things, why things were built, and what they mean to us now.
That's right.
One final point I want to make about the wall. Obviously, there are parallels and, you know, direct correlations we can make to modern times, right? I've gotten a lot of requests about the Berlin Wall.
Mm-hmm.
And I've obviously the connection is the wall that the states have always talked about building.
Yes.
So this is one thing that I think is a really good topic that I came across, which is to say that the Great Wall never failed to keep China safe. When China was overtaken by enemies, which did happen, it was not because of the wall, but rather because of the poverty and the weakness of the government at the time.
Right.
It was always infiltrated from within, and it was always when China was too poor and too weak to defend itself. And I think that's a good point to say that, you know, a wall may be a point of defense, but if you don't have the political integrity and a people that is strong enough to actually defend itself and, you know, not succumb to foreign influences, right?
Right.
That is when you're going to be overtaken.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I think the other thing that I took away from this is that the wall was as much a symbolic show of strength as it was, you know, a physical deterrent. So, I mean, I am of the opinion that if the states goes ahead and spends untold amounts of money on this wall, it's not going to solve their problems. It's
no,
not
exactly.
Going to halt illegal immigration or anything. It is going to stand as a symbol of the barriers between,
yeah.
It, a symbol of the barriers that the U.S. has built up, you know, socially and culturally and economically against the rest of the world. So, I mean, yeah, I guess that's it. Don't put your hopes in the wall, because it's not the wall, it's the administration.
Exactly. All right. Thank you so much for bearing with us on this episode. It's been a rough week, and I know that there's a lot going on out there. I hope everyone is staying safe. I hope everyone is participating and supporting the Black Lives Movement however you can, and hopefully this was a good little distraction.
But don't stay distracted. Now the podcast is over, so let's keep doing what we can.
That's right. Let us know how you feel about this episode. Let us know if you like having John take more of a lead role on this, or if you want him to just go back to being dumb and making jokes. Hit us up on our social media accounts. We've got our account on Instagram and Facebook at Measure to Metric. We have our website, measuretometric.com. And if you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a rating on whatever podcasting platform you're listening to us on right now. Really helps us And thank you to Astronomic Audio for sound engineering this episode and all of our episodes.
Single one. They also got us hooked up, got our feet off the ground. They know their stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Terrific guys. And John, you got anything else?
Oh, is it my, can I say it? As always, remember to measure in metric.
There you go.
All right.